While we're in Washington, we may as well note that Mr. Sumner Wells has got back there, too. We don't suppose that he's a wiser and a better man. His tour of Europe will hardly have made him any better, and he's probably no wiser. What he has learned, he's going to tell to Mr. Cordell Hull, and after him, to President Roosevelt.
Hello and welcome to episode 52 of American History 2. I am Mark McClay, and as always, I'm joined by Malcolm Craig. Hello, Malcolm.
Hello, Mark. Yes, delighted to be back for episode 52, and delighted to have a guest who actually prodded us into thinking about stuff that we don't often cover on the podcast, particularly sex and sexuality. So Chris Parks sort of said, hey, you guys don't cover these topics very often. I could come on and talk about my research and the areas of my interest. And that's a fantastic idea. So we're delighted to welcome King's College London's Chris Parks on today to talk about sex, sexuality and Sumner Wells, a historical figure who some of you may not be aware of, but we're going to cover in quite a lot of detail today. So welcome, Chris. Thank you for coming on. Thank you for suggesting the topics that we're going to be covering today. And could you give us just a minute on yourself and your area of research?
Of course. Thank you, Malcolm. Thank you for having me on, first of all. It's great to be on such a venerable podcast as this. Episode 52 is really getting up there. My work is on 20th century political and diplomatic history in the United States. I've spent or focused mostly for the last 10 years or so on the life and career of a man named, as you mentioned, Sumner Wells. Wells was a prominent, very prominent diplomat in the Franklin Roosevelt administration. He is known to anybody who studies Latin American history for setting up the Good Neighbor Policy, which is just kind of a reconfiguration of American attitudes towards Latin America. He was involved in pre-war American peace initiatives in Europe, as well as wartime planning for post-war world organizations and so forth. But perhaps most infamously, he is known for not being able to put any of those plans into fruition because in 1943 he was forced to resign when his political opponents conspired to spread rumors, true rumors, that he had solicited sex from male railway porters while riding on a train with Franklin Roosevelt a few years earlier. My work has looked at that incident in particular, Wells's career more generally, and the role of sexuality—the role that sexuality played in shaping his personality, his interactions with the Roosevelt administration—and I suppose, to the furthest extent, looking at how American state practice, bureaucracy, diplomatic practice, everything, how sexuality has inflected that and informed that and been informed by these state how sexuality has been informed by these state practices in turn.
Brilliant. Well, I'm really looking forward to hearing all about Sumner Wells. And before we get to Wells, I want to zoom out quite far and go back a wee bit. And in preparation for this podcast, I read a book review of yours in which you were sort of looking at a book that had examined the medieval and pre-modern attitudes to sex and sexuality. And in the book, you said that, you know, definitions such as gays and lesbians would be unrecognizable to inhabitants of the medieval and pre-modern world. And I was just wondering what you meant by that. And also if you could kind of relate it to what is another very broad question. Would these terms have been recognizable to those in 18th and 19th century America?
Certainly. Well, the idea behind saying that contemporary terms about sexuality would be unrecognizable to previous centuries is rooted in an idea that's pretty ubiquitous in the history of sexuality these days, called the social construction theory of sexuality. This is opposition to an essentialist interpretation of sexuality. The social construction point of view says the way that societies understand and individuals within societies understand how sexuality and gender and personality interact with each other is contingent upon the circumstances of that society. So how they were socialized, the configurations of the world around them, and so forth. What that means is that there's no sort of internal, innate, consistent feature that's independent of our sort of social upbringing that one can point to as being a key characteristic of sexuality that endures through, you know, across centuries and across cultures. It was to some extent more common in decades past to imagine that, say, 500 or 1,000 years ago, you could speak of someone being gay in the same way that you would speak of someone being gay today. Most historians working on sexuality today, those who follow the social constructivist view of it, say, actually, no. What we call gay is an understanding of how your sexuality is a component of your identity and a manifestation of a deep sort of personal behavior that simply wouldn't have applied given the way that people saw the world in centuries past. You know, the word gay, it's actually, the word gay specifically is many centuries old, but it only took on its common connotation in the last century. Words like homosexual, bisexual, heterosexual, transgendered, these were only concocted in the late 19th century. And the idea, I suppose, is that it was the assigning of terms that assumed that sexuality was an inborn trait that changed the way we thought about how sexuality and changed it dramatically from what it would have been centuries earlier.
And if we kind of move into the kind of the early part of the 20th century, thinking about ideas of, you know, sex and sexuality, particularly in America, what were kind of like the societal and legal attitudes towards, and I'm going to use a term that wasn't in common usage at the time, but LGBT citizens, as we would now say in America, what in the first half of the 20th century? Had there been changes in previous eras in the 19th century, but what were the societal and legal attitudes?
Sure. This is a great way of illustrating this social construction in idea about sexuality. Prior to the late 19th century, the terms that would have been used to describe what we think of as gay or lesbian or bisexual would have been something more like sinner or sodomite, because that's how they understood same-sex attraction to be. It was, you know, highly Christian society, and in their view, same-sex relations were sinful, and to practice them was to commit a sin. This said nothing about who you were internally, but it just, it was just a matter of your relationship with God. You could go to confession, be absolved of the sin, and that was that. People didn't assume that you were, more likely to commit that sin again than you were anything else. That began to change in the late 19th century with this more taxonomical view, more scientific view of human sexuality, and specifically the introduction of this taxonomy of different sexual groups, homosexual, heterosexual, bisexual, and so on. There were dozens of different terms people came up with at the time. That changed people's attitudes as to sort of what they were dealing with. No longer were you dealing with individual acts of sinfulness. You're dealing with a category of people, a class, a sort of caste who all shared this same common characteristic of same-sex attraction or opposite-sex attraction if you're talking about heterosexual people. That in turn informs a kind of updating of a legal structure towards these people that had existed for quite a while. In the United States Northern North America, what eventually became the United States, same-sex attraction was highly penalized. It was outlawed under sodomy laws that had been imported from England with English settlement and with pretty much every other settler society in North America. That was propagated through state laws and local codes that prohibited all of a massive variety of different sorts of behaviors. Same-sex sexual contact, same-sex relationships. There was no recognition of any sort of same-sex relationship at this time, in these years, like the way that we have recognition for same-sex marriage today. And by the early 20th century, there was a fairly rigid system in place whereby sexual deviations from the sexual norm, from the heterosexual norm, were very strictly policed, very harshly punished. Even a single accusation or conviction of same-sex or sodomy, as they would have called it, would bring 25 years in prison or even capital punishment in certain jurisdictions. And by the early 20th century, these sorts of legal and social prohibitions were very much in place, very strictly enforced, and were about to change, although not perhaps in very predictable ways. I don't want to leave you, I know I've spoken for a while just there, but I don't want to leave you the impression that this was all just doom and gloom for, let's call them gay people, lesbians, at this time. Despite the legal prohibitions, despite the social obloquy, it's worth noting, you know, to call someone gay or to be accused of same-sex attraction at this time is sort of like being called a pedophile today. I mean, it was absolutely, you were a pariah, even for the accusation of this. Despite this prohibition, in many places in the United States, there were nascent communities of like-minded people, of what we would call gay people today, who had, you know, a sort of thriving subculture of dances, of tea rooms, of shows, and of house parties, as well as, you know, even businesses and community organizations that they used to organize themselves. They did so under extremely hostile circumstances, but that sort of community did still exist.
So, I mean, given everything you've just said there, I'm trying to maybe narrow it down to one or two real instances where it becomes official policy to discriminate against gay people. As you said, that's not what they would have been known at the time. But I was wondering if you're aware of what the background to the sort of the infamous blue discharge or blue ticket was that was introduced in 1916 as a way to sort of dishonorably discharge gay people. I mean, why did the US military feel the need to introduce this measure? Was this just another example of Woodrow Wilson being the horrible person he was, or does it go deeper than that?
I don't want to miss a chance of reaffirming that Woodrow Wilson was a horrible person, but this one we can't blame on him. In my reading of it, and there's been some great work on this done by Marco Canaday and Alan Barabay, Randy Schiltz even as well, the blue discharges were a name given by soldiers for the blue paper that a certain kind of discharge was issued, that could be issued to them. It was introduced in 1916, but it was introduced, really for, you know, underage soldiers, for people who had signed up without their parents' permission before they were 21. It became something associated with, what they called sodomists, but with gay people, and also, regrettably with, in many cases with African Americans as well, only in the lead up to World War II, in the United States. Effectively, what happened was that in the rush for mobilization in the late 1930s and early 1940s, the Army suddenly discovered that there were hundreds of thousands, if not millions, more homosexuals than they had ever thought could possibly exist. To be gay was completely, engage in any sexual contact or any romantic relationships with someone of the same sex was not just illegal, but it was grounds for dismissal from the Army. And, fairly mid-ranking, forces, you know, officers in the armed forces, had so many of these cases coming in such a short space of time that what they wanted to do was just clear them out. So instead of court-martialing them, which is the official, which would have been the official, route for discharging, or getting these sorts of people out of the Army, they issued what were called, blue tickets, these notices that were discharges that were really for administrative purposes. Like I said, they'd been initially for people who had signed up too young. This expanded by leaps and bounds as mobilization continued. And there was a bureaucratic tussle between the Judge Advocate General's office and more practical-minded officers who, over what would be done with these people. Do you continue putting them through the court-martialing system, or do you just let these blue tickets discharge them as quickly as possible? Ultimately, the wartime exigencies forced the quickest route possible for discharging people, which was the blue tickets. Sadly, though, this did not end the obloquy of having been discharged. People who received blue discharges or blue tickets were nevertheless dogged by them in civilian life. It seems strange now, but in the late 1940s and 50s and even into the 60s in the United States, if you wanted a job, you were expected to show your discharge papers, the same way we're expected to show, say, university transcripts today. Well, if you had a blue discharge, everybody knew that that was associated or that was used unofficially but commonly to get rid of gay soldiers. And that meant that you were ineligible for these jobs as well.
Yeah, I mean, to pick up on that point you've just mentioned there, I mean, I'm familiar with Margaret Kennedy's study of the GI Bill, which was, you know, a piece of legislation that arguably, you know, has been said to have created the middle class in America, you know. All the millions of soldiers that came home and were able to get favorable mortgages and therefore get nice property and jobs and everything off the back of that. And she argues that essentially what it also helps to do, the GI Bill, not only does it largely exclude African Americans, it also excludes gay Americans and therefore helps to build what she calls the straight state. And indeed, there seems to be around the Great Depression and World War II, these two twin calamities that have a huge impact on every range of American society. One of these weird impacts seems to be that they need to make it more official that the state is against gay people. I mean, why do you think that happens at that time? What is going on that means that there needs to be, you know, a sort of official line from the US government that they're against, forms of sexuality that aren't considered the norm?
At the risk of sounding self-aggrandizing, that is the work of my career, to answer that exact question. Because it is bewildering and fascinating, and for me anyways, fascinating because it's been kind of assumed to be automatic. It's, you know, it just seems so inexorable. Of course, the state, as it expanded, you know, with the wartime, you know, first with the New Deal, then the wartime emergency, then the national security state, of course it would start to clamp down more on certain sorts of behaviors and activities. And yet, why was it that, that gay sexuality, queer sexuality, whatever you want to call it, became one of those targets is a real question. It doesn't have an obvious answer. Some historians have offered, I think, some very compelling explanations for why it happened the way it did. One that I'm fond of is was forwarded by a man named Douglas Charles. He wrote a fantastic book about the FBI's what was called Sex Deviants Unit. It was their the part of the FBI that investigated all crimes related to sex, everything from rape and sexual assault to prostitution to consensual sex between men or women, or, you know, between two men, between two women. And in it, as part of his interpretation of or explanation of why the FBI created this program and why it executed it with such vehemence in the 1930s and 40s, Douglas argued that there was a shift in attitudes occasioned by the Great Depression. And I've got a quote of it right here, and I'll just read it off verbatim if that's okay, because he does it better than I ever could. If during the 1930s, gays were regarded as threats to home, family, and society at large amid the Great Depression and the advent of the New Deal, that perceived threat was refocused and magnified during the 1940s and wartime. Gays were no longer perceived as simply a criminal or societal threat, but now a national security threat, and concerns mounted that enemies of the United States were working to disrupt the country from within. And all of this sort of stems from an argument he made earlier that in the 1930s, there was kind of the shock of the Great Depression, kind of presented an existential challenge to, well, specifically men in the United States, to the idea of the working man, to masculinity more broadly. So many millions of men had been thrown out of work, had lost their farms, had up and left their families because they couldn't support them, that there was a subsequently, especially once good times returned and the wartime emergency compounded it, there was a kind of backlash, an effort to reassert masculinity with particularly vehement and well-policed boundaries of what was acceptable behavior and what was unacceptable behavior for men and women, what were acceptable roles for men and women, and hence what was unacceptable. And that which was unacceptable not only became unusual or, you know, sort of psychologically strange, but dangerous.
Yeah, I would second your recommendation of Doug Charles's book. It's a really brilliant work of research and analysis. And as, you know, piggybacking on what you're saying there, it's fascinating the parallel rise or the interlinked rise of the national security state. Franklin D. Roosevelt's invocation of social and then national security within the construct of the New Deal and the Great Depression into the 1940s and wartime, and then in the immediate aftermath when Truman takes over, the creation of a modern American national security state, and the way that's interlinked with, as you point out, these ideas of masculinity and sexuality and all these different different areas. It's fine. I think Charles's book is fantastic in that regard in showing the way these threads go through, and his articles as well, which I've used in teaching, which we'll come back to actually later on, talking about teaching these topics. So I'd like us to turn now to one of the key figures in our discussion today, Sumner Wells, your area of particular interest. You know, we're now into wartime, the Great Depression, we're into World War II, this period of national emergency, of the kind of the rise of ideas of national security. And into this we have Sumner Wells. So we've talked briefly about Wells in your introduction. Could we just cover that in a little bit more detail again? Who is Sumner Wells? What is his background? How does he get into government? And what role does he play within the Roosevelt administration?
Well, Sumner Wells, start at the beginning. Sumner Wells was born in 1892. He was the son of, or the latest son in a long line of very venerable Wellses that stretch all the way back to the colonial period. He was part of that very elite East Coast Brahmin class that was really at its apogee of power in the late 19th century. He went to some of the finest schools in the United States. He went to Groton, which is their version of Eton and Harrow. He went to Harvard. He was, and at both of those schools, he was many years behind, but he got to know Frank, among other people, Franklin Roosevelt. So he was a family friend. He was well bred. He was reasonably intelligent, and he decided in the mid 19 teens to enter the State Department. And that was really the turning point of his life. He entered the State Department that year and really never looked back. He was a career diplomat for the next 30 years. And even once he was forced from office, he still remained a very prominent commentator on international affairs. His route to power and prominence was really through his association with Franklin Roosevelt. As I said, they'd been boyhood friends, and they also kind of had slightly parallel paths together. Wells and Roosevelt were both sort of rising stars in the Wilson administration. But then in the early 1920s, they both had major setbacks. Roosevelt because he was afflicted with poliomyelitis, and Wells because he was in a strange foreshadowing of what would happen later. He was forced from office when he had a divorce and married the daughter, or rather when he divorced the daughter of a prominent Republican senator. Put him afoul of the Republicans who were in charge at the time, and so his career kind of ended almost before it got off the ground. Together, they made a bit of a political comeback when Roosevelt was elected governor of New York, and in 1933 as president, or 1932 as president, becoming president in 1933. He was so close to Roosevelt personally, and I think temperamentally so close to Roosevelt, that they made a very good team. Roosevelt trusted Wells, and he liked the way that Wells thought and acted in a way that Roosevelt didn't really admire many of the other people who were involved in foreign policy at the time, most notably the actual Secretary of State, who was named Cordell Hull. Roosevelt had him in his cabinet and appreciated him for his political stature, but didn't really agree with Hall on a lot of major matters. He tended to prefer Wells, and that's why the two, that's why, well, Hall and Wells developed this very intense rivalry that contributed quite a bit to his downfall.
So he's a senior figure, one of the most senior figures in FDR's foreign policy apparatus, you know, a key thinker and a key influence on FDR and his foreign policy, yet he's forced out of government. You know, so we're told that when it's revealed that he'd been soliciting men for sex. To start off with, before we get into the reactions and responsibilities and everything, what's the actual story here? What happened to Wells? Who accused Wells? And what exactly is it he is accused of?
Well, it is one of the most fascinating tales. I was about to say sordid tales, but I'm trying to avoid using that sort of condemnatory language again. It is one of the most riveting stories of political intrigue from Franklin Roosevelt's Washington that I've ever read. Wells, it starts in 1937. Wells was up for a promotion to Under Secretary of State, which is the second in command of the State Department. He was up against a man named R. Walton Moore. There was a very intense bureaucratic battle between Moore and Wells. Wells won. Moore was unhappy with this, and along with a confederate of his named William Bullitt, who was another prominent diplomat, they nursed a grudge against Wells for many years after. But they couldn't do anything about it until the fall of 1940, when Wells, on a train, returning actually from the funeral of the former Speaker of the House of Representatives, William Bankhead, returning on a train with Roosevelt from that funeral, Wells propositioned several of the porters on the train to come back to his room, offering them money for various sexual acts. Reports of this incident were circulated among the train company and eventually made it back to the FBI, who conducted an investigation. They interviewed all the different Pullman porters on the train. They actually interviewed porters on another train that Wells took 3 weeks later, where he behaved in very much the same way. That report was commissioned in, let's say, December of 1940 and delivered to Roosevelt in January of 1941, where it was quietly buried. Roosevelt didn't act on it. He insisted that Wells travel with a valet from the, there on out, but he didn't act on it. However, R. Walton Moore, Wells' erstwhile rival, had contacts in the Southern Railway Company and got wind of what had happened. He used those contacts combined with William Bullitt's contacts in the federal government. He was a well-connected enough diplomat that he had a lot of people to talk to eventually get a hold of that FBI report, or at least get a look at it. And by the end of 1941, they had accumulated enough evidence for William Bullitt to ask for an audience with Franklin Roosevelt and present him with this information and ask him point blank to fire Wells because of what he had done. Roosevelt again refused because he trusted Wells. He liked Wells and he felt that Wells, despite what he had done, was still going to be a valuable member of his administration. But that's where this story really takes a dark turn, because Bullitt and Moore simply would not take no for an answer, or specifically Bullitt, because Moore had died by this point. Bullitt spent the next 2 years spreading rumors about Wells, telling this story to anybody who would listen, and trying to kind of reach this critical mass of knowledge about Wells among the well-connected and among the those in the Roosevelt administration, those in the press, and those in the Republican Party who would want to make hay of this if they wanted to, such that Roosevelt would be put in a position where he was forced to ask for Wells's resignation. That critical mass was reached by July of 1943. And you can actually see it in of all things, the documents about the social registers in Washington, like the guest lists for parties that the State Department was putting on in this time. You can see that in the beginning of 1943, all the people who were invited, they were accepting. And all the important people, you know, the secretary of such and such and the undersecretary of this and that, they were all accepting. By July of 1943, all of them were regrets. They were turning down these invitations to go to Wells's party. And that was one of the lovely little things I found in my research to sort of show just how this subterranean rumor mill had reached this point where Wells had pretty much been isolated, even though there had been no official public accusation of anything he had done.
So you talked there about how FDR, when he's initially presented with the report about Wells, that he buries it. And then when he's approached later on to try and get him to do something about Wells, that he does nothing about it. Why does FDR behave in this? Is FDR the pragmatic politician? He wants to retain the services of a trusted and, you know, very efficient advisor. Is it because of his friendship with Wells? Is he actually not bothered about Wells's sexuality? What is it about FDR? What is causing him to behave in this way?
That's a great question. And all of those angles have been explored by people looking into this. There's no doubting that Roosevelt really appreciated the role that Wells served in the State Department. Roosevelt's on record over and over of really not liking the State Department. It was full of people that he didn't trust. He thought that it was riddled with Republicans, you know, at the lower levels, because they'd been in power for so long. There's some evidence to say that he had kind of tussled with the State Department when he had been Assistant Secretary of the Navy under Wilson. What is undeniable is that the Secretary of State, Cordell Hull, was someone that Roosevelt did not have as good a working relationship with. Hull, you know, a bit of background on Hull. He was a septuagenarian, senator and, you know, everything really from Tennessee. He'd been around forever and had done most every job you could think of. And, you know, when Roosevelt appointed him to Secretary of State, he said, he's the only member of my cabinet who brings me, political power that I don't have in my own right. So I think he saw in Hull someone that he couldn't kind of bowl over and he couldn't sort of roll over, and who preternaturally, just by temperament, was a very cautious, very sort of slow moving person. Wells was the complete opposite. Wells was someone who was just like him in many ways. They'd come from the same background. Wells was a particularly agile and sort of, perspicacious sort of bureaucrat. He was very good at making a lot of things work at once and you know, setting an objective and pursuing it doggedly and finishing it as quickly as possible and as efficiently as possible. And I think in some ways, Roosevelt sympathized with Wells. I certainly argue in my work that the two of them shared a common understanding of what it was like to be ostracized for things that were kind of beyond their control and that had to do with their bodies, as well as their relationships. So Roosevelt, because of his disability and because of, you know, the relationship that he had with Eleanor, Wells, because of his sexuality and the fact that he had, gone through a divorce himself. As to, Roosevelt being sort of particularly sympathetic to Wells because of what he knew about his sexuality once he knew it, the jury's a little bit out on that. There's evidence to show that Roosevelt could be quite homophobic. There was a scandal that he was, that he sort of oversaw as Assistant Secretary of the Navy, in 1920 that pointed to him expressing some pretty homophobic views. And yet he was clearly aware of some of the, of what Wells had done on the train by as late as late 1940, and he kept Wells around and genuinely, from the documents I've seen, genuinely did not seem bothered, you know, in the way that you'll read some people having kind of visceral reactions to even the mere mention of same-sex attraction. Roosevelt didn't express that at all. So Wells was compatible on a kind of professional level. He was useful to have politically. And he was not a liability in the way that others might have thought, at least not to, Roosevelt didn't see him as a liability in the ways that others might have thought. So I think that's why he kept him around. Roosevelt could get done what he wanted more effectively.
And what's the outcome of all of this? What happens to Wells? So he's, This social opprobrium is swirling around Washington. People are not attending parties and galas and all that kind of thing. His name is Mudd. Maybe, maybe not. What happens to Wells? What are the outcomes of all of this?
So one of the reasons that Roosevelt kept Wells around was that he was quite sure no one would report on what Wells had done. The press simply did not publish these sorts of stories, and that was true. Roosevelt had a lot of reason to think that. However, in what was really a novelty for wartime Washington, for Washington generally, Wells' story started to trickle into the papers. It was only in gossip columns, and it was only in a very sort of hush-hush way, but the rumors about Wells began to seep into a kind of semi-public discourse or semi-public level of publicity in a way that no scandal like that really had ever had before. Wells was, or Roosevelt was put in a position where the stories about Wells were just on the cusp of being reported publicly. Roosevelt had been able to bury them in 1941 because he had just won re-election and because the wartime emergency had sort of taken over. But by 1943, Roosevelt's starting to lose, well, he's starting to lose his strength because his health is failing, but he's starting to lose some of his political capital too. He's, you know, the war is going on, his administration's losing popularity as, you know, his casualties mount. The 1944 election is coming up. So Roosevelt was running for a fourth term in office. I think he was thinking ahead to the post-war settlement. He was going to need a functioning State Department in order to, you know, push through all of the diplomatic agreements that were going to be necessary to bring the war to a close and set up the UN. And by late 1943, he simply didn't have that anymore. Hull wanted Wells gone. They had always been at each other's throats anyways, but now Hull was making it clear that he wouldn't stand for Wells being around. And if Hull resigned, I think Roosevelt knew that he was going to look, that was going to be a mortal blow to his administration. So he made a difficult call, I think a difficult call for him, and cut Wells loose.
And so what happens to Wells thereafter? Is he kind of like cast out into the wilderness, never to be heard from again, becoming an obscure figure? Or does he maintain some kind of public profile?
Well, both things happen. Initially, he is not just prominent, he's celebrated. There are boxes of letters that were sent by random people around the country to Wells in the aftermath of his resignation, begging him to come back, professing their support for him, asking him to run for Senate, and I even found one asking him to run for president. He was a celebrity, and he was a very prominent one. It didn't hurt for Wells that the resignation was because the circumstances of the conspiracy that forced Wells out were not published, at least not widely. The official story was that Wells had been pushed out because of a bureaucratic tussle with Cordell Hull, and as a part of, you know, some people said part of a broader conspiracy to purge the Roosevelt administration of left-leaning politicians or left-leaning figures, of which Wells was allegedly one. I'm not sure how true that was, but even besides that, he was taken as a kind of cause célèbre among a certain portion of the American public. And as it happened, Wells was happy to lean into this. He spent the next 4 or 5 years writing books that were bestsellers about foreign policy and about, you know, his own take on how the United States should craft itself in the post-war world. And he was, you know, speaking every week on radio shows, and he had his own radio sort of column that he did. So he was very, very prominent until 1948 or so. And in 1948, there were sort of a succession of calamities in Wells' life and more broadly in political culture. And I don't want to get into too many details about it, but for one thing, Wells just, he had a what's euphemized as an accident. He very nearly died when of exposure when he sort of passed out in the on a very cold winter night near his house. I've done some research into this, and there's evidence to show that indeed, while he may have passed out, it may have been that he was actually out cruising that night. That he was out visiting someone at a neighboring farm who may have had he may have been trying to have a tryst with, or may have just had a tryst with. besides that, by 1948, the political atmosphere in the United States had changed quite dramatically. This was the start of the Red and, more importantly, the Lavender Scare, where anybody with even the faintest whiff of difficulty or of so-called subversion of association with the Soviet Union or association with non-normative sexuality was persecuted very, very heavily, forced out of government, forced out of their jobs, and ostracized. And although Wells was never implicated in any of these directly, he was implicated indirectly. He was called as a witness at the trial of Alger Hiss, for instance. He was there to verify the authenticity of the infamous pumpkin papers that were used by Whitaker Chambers to implicate Hiss. One of his close aides in the State Department, Lawrence Duggan, he was also implicated in the investigations into alleged communist infiltration of the State Department. And Lawrence Duggan actually committed suicide he killed himself a few months before Wells had his accident in December of 1948. And as part of my research, I argue that Wells was kind of tried in absentia in de facto, he was tried for the scandal that never quite broke about him, because the archetype of the Lavender Scare and to some extent the Red Scare was based in effect, it had its blueprint in Wells's scandal. The idea of a well-to-do, effete, well-connected, especially State Department official at the highest ranks of government, who nevertheless contains some allegedly nefarious element of him, and sort of subverting the United States government from within. That was the narrative of the Red and the Lavender Scare, and that was the narrative of Wells's scandal as well. So in a way, I think he was kind of tried after the fact, in the court of public opinion. And by the end of 1948, and certainly by the time, Harry Truman was elected in his own right and a completely different organization took power, Wells became persona non grata. And over the next few years, he slowly faded more and more from public life. He disappeared entirely after 1956, when there was one last sort of public splash about him in a gossip magazine called Confidential. In the run-up to the 1956 presidential election, they did a splashy cover with Wells right on the front cover saying, "We accuse Sumner Wells." And it was a fairly comprehensive account of everything that had happened in Wells' scandal that had not been reported on 13 years earlier. That was really the end of Wells' public life. And until he died about 5 years later, he was completely absent from public life and sadly leading an increasingly isolated and, I think, increasingly lonely life as his health failed. And he eventually died of pancreatic cancer in 1961.
So, I mean, that's a rather sad end for Wells' legacy. I mean, there's a couple of things that I pick up upon. I find it really interesting. I was looking him up, and he still, even towards the end of his life, married again. He had three wives or something. And also, this a sort of scandal, sort of in a similar way, and somewhat repeats itself in the 1960s when you have, Lyndon Johnson discovers his most close advisor, Walter Jenkins, had solicited sex in Washington and was found in that way, and he actually got rid of Walter Jenkins so he wouldn't pay the price at the ballot box. So it's quite interesting to see that there was still echoes of this 30, 40 years later. But I was wondering, in what sense do you... What is Wells' legacy? And I'm thinking particularly for, LGBT advocates. Is he seen as a heroic figure, or is he problematic in that regard? What's your sense?
For LGBT historians, Wells is something that is commented upon. He's a reference point, but there really hasn't been a lot of inquiry or a lot of digging around into his legacy. Positive or negative, like, no one's turned him into a folk hero the way that, say, in the United Kingdom, Alan Turing has been turned into kind of a queer icon, a queer hero, or the way that, you know, you look at other figures, Oscar Wilde, or even someone who's kind of contemporary with Wells, Frank Kameny, who was one of the first people fired from the federal government in the Lavender Scare and subsequently became a gay rights activist. Wells has never received that kind of attention, and there might be reasons for that. In some of the work that I've done on Wells, what I've found is, yes, absolutely, a story of a brilliant man who dedicated himself to his country, to help overcome, enormous, challenges, you know, during World War II and during the Great Depression, and who was nevertheless destroyed because of the endemic and ferocious homophobia of the time. At the same time, Wells, as a person, I don't think was a terribly chipper person to be around. He was rather elitist. He expressed, I suppose, like many people of that time, but he openly expressed racist views. His behavior, even in sort of analyzing the incidents that he's had, the incidents that brought about his resignation, the solicitations he did of railway porters, there's some troublesome activities there as well. I mean, you have to consider the context of what he was doing. He was a very prominent white man in the South in the 1940s, propositioning black porters, and putting them in a position where if they accepted, they're doing something illegal that if they got found out, if it was found out, they'd be fired and possibly sent to jail, and that would be the end of their livelihoods, you know, for their families and everyone. Or if they refused, they have angered one of the most prominent and well-respected men in the country. And if that man then comes back and accuses them of something, who's the public going to believe? Who's a policeman going to believe? So, I mean, the way I read some of these encounters, it's hard to turn Wells into a saint or to just write a hagiographic account of his career. That said, I still think his is a story worth telling. I think his is a story that informs us about how sex and sexuality and the apparatus of the state can intertwine and affect outcomes that really wouldn't have otherwise been explicable, but for analysis of the role of sexuality. So all told, I think Wells is, Wells has a complicated legacy, one that, and this is leaving aside the fact, by the way, that virtually every other historian who's looked into him has spoken of his sexuality as if just being gay in the first place is kind of a problem, if not something outright to condemn. So it's a complicated legacy.
Okay, and so to round off today's discussion, when we asked you, you know, if there was any questions you wanted us to ask, is the one thing you mentioned was that you'd quite like to talk about teaching, the history of sex and sexuality. And I was just wondering, like, so first of all, why was that what you wanted to talk about? And second of all, what is your advice for any, you know, young lecturers or school teachers or whatever out there who want to talk about these subjects, which, if we are being honest, aren't talked about as much as, you know, the history of race relations or feminism, or anything like that. So if you could answer those last couple of questions.
Sure. I raised it because I'm a teacher. I mean, I'm a historian, obviously, and I love doing research, but I think it's just as important to know how to disseminate that research. And as much as we might like to think that people are actually picking up copies of the Journal of the History of Sexuality and reading them cover to cover, most people don't. So most people's introduction to this kind of history is in the classroom. And I think because of that, it behooves us to understand as best as possible what are the best ways to tell these sorts of stories, how do we integrate them into broader history curricula, and to address the same problem, or the problem that you alluded to right there. LGBT history, history of sexuality generally, is today I don't think thought of as unworthy the way it was, say, 30 or 40 or 50 years ago. However, it is still seen as somewhat peripheral. I've talked to other historians who've attempted to include LGBT history in, you know, like school curricula. And the pushback they get these days isn't from people who are expressing homophobic views saying that it shouldn't be taught, but just from people who are saying, well, if they're, you know, do they really have time to study this? If they learn about the Stonewall riots, isn't that a class that's being taken away from teaching them about the, you know, about Brown versus Board of Education or about the Great Depression or about something else? So there's kind of a competition for space there. My advice to teachers who are presented with those sorts of problems, and really to all teachers who want to include LGBT history topics, is to remind them that, stories about sexuality, stories about people who are, you know, gay or lesbian or, who are queer, however they define themselves, they are imbricated in all the same stories, that we've been telling or that we've been using in history classes since time immemorial. To give you a good example, if you want to teach students about the civil rights movement, about the African-American civil rights movement in the 1960s, of course, teach them about Brown versus Board of Education, teach them about Emmett Till, teach them about the SCLC and SNCC, but also teach them about Bayard Rustin. Rustin was one of the most prominent African-American civil rights leaders at the time. He was a fascinating character, a pacifist and a communist during World War II, which is not an easy time to be those things. He was one of the key organizers of the March on Washington in He was one of the key organizers of the March on Washington in 1963, where Martin Luther King Jr. gave his "I Have a Dream" speech, and he was remarkably, unabashedly for the time, gay, and carried on same-sex relationships all through his life. Teaching about Bayard Rustin helps you teach a myriad of different stories about the civil rights movement, about the sorts of pressures the civil rights movement was under, because Bayard Rustin, as you probably aren't surprised, was being surveilled and investigated by the FBI, both for his sexuality and for his political leanings. And it's a way of showing, maybe most importantly, of showing that queer people have been as much a part of the official story of history as all the prime ministers and the diplomats and the generals have been, who for a terribly long time have gotten the preponderance of attention.
And I think that is a brilliant note upon which to end. Thank you very much for that, Chris. Really enjoyed hearing about Sumner Wells and the history kind of gender and sexuality in the United States. And it is definitely, I think, as you pointed out, you know, to me when you contacted me a few months ago, it's a topic or multiple topics that we need to cover, in more detail in future episodes. So thank you for coming on, spending the time talking about your research, about Wells and about the topic more widely.
Oh, it was my absolute pleasure to do so, and I hope I've done the topic justice.
Well, you definitely did. And thank you to you, listener, as always. Thanks, Malcolm.
Thank you, Mark.
And we'll be back next month with another podcast. Goodbye.
Bye.